I'm not sure if we selected the title or were given it or one of my colleagues selected the title, but it's not a bad one. And this is, again, quite a significant shift of pace from the previous talk. So in that sense, you can relax a little bit. But let me tell you where the title comes from. What was the picks and shovels analogy come from? And it was a phrase that first was used in the business somewhere about 2006, I think, when we got asked to write part of an article that went into a Times nanotechnology supplement. Now, whether that's a good thing for science or not, when the Times does a supplement on a piece of science, either you get very excited or you start to worry, depending on how you take it. But we were talking then about nanotechnologies and all the buzz back in, that was 2006, that was around that. And as a company which has been based on scientific instrumentation and scientific equipment, you people out there are clearly our customers, or many of you are, and are the users of those equipment, and are the people who do the science based on our equipment. But clearly you can only do that science using a certain piece of equipment in a lot of cases. The comparison was to the gold rush, if you like, that you are the people who are doing the prospecting, looking for those nuggets of gold where you will find the particular technique measurement that shines the light into a piece of science or takes the technology forward. What we need to be able to do is provide you with the right tools to enable that discovery. So that idea that tools enable discovery is very much behind what we do in Oxford Instruments as a company as a whole. Behind that, and this is one equation, so I thought, I can just about get away with one very non-mathematical equation in it. That's because I'm an applied physicist, not a real physicist, as I was always told at university. But that idea that new ideas and new tools are what makes new science. That might betray my experimentalist background, but you as the scientists have the new ideas, but those new ideas need to be developed and demonstrated and tested on those sets of new tools and therefore generate the new science. So it's very important that we have that symbiotic relationship between those ideas and the tools to pull it along. And of course we know that if you go back and look at historical science, a lot of the early scientists' work was indeed in making those tools themselves. Now with research assessment exercises and so on, you don't have that luxury, or maybe you don't want that pain, and we take on some of that role. Why is this sort of dialogue like today important for us though? If like me you're interested in some of the thinking and the background and the theories behind things like product development, then you might have come across some of these ideas that were from a chap called von Hippel back in the late 70s and early 80s, where he started to say, this is not just about when a manufacturer has a great idea and has a development idea for a new product, a new piece of scientific equipment, and then goes out and says to the customer base, hey, what do you think about it? Something where the manufacturer is really the active partner. He said, actually, if you're looking for very novel, innovative products, you need to go out and look at what is happening out in the customer base. What are the things that the customers are inventing for themselves because no one else is doing it? And hook onto that and say, is that an indicator of a general need? And how can you take that forward? And that's a thinking that's really very embedded in where we are now and very true as we work in that quantum technologies field, that we provide tools, people start to add things onto those tools, we hear back from what they're doing and can enhance that and keep turning that around, so hopefully it gets easier and easier for you to get to that time to first experiment and time between experiments to stimulate the science and the feedback loop of the science. So what I want to talk about really a bit today is what's in that toolbox, where are we and how's that toolbox evolving. This is always in the danger of sounding like a sales pitch, and it's not supposed to be that at all. It's about saying, here's where the toolbox is evolving, here's the things we're hearing back from the customers. And I'd really like to use this as the opportunity to be a stimulus for you to come back, and whether that's in the question time or afterwards or later on, to say, hey, you know what would really make the difference is if we had a tool that could do this. These are the things that would really enhance our next steps forward. Oxford Instruments widely, we've been around as a company for nigh on 60 years. We have a big broad range of things in that toolbox. And as with any piece of science, you know, you come to solve a problem and you dig into your toolbox and say, find me a tool that's going to shine some light onto that problem, that's going to help me solve that, do that piece of analysis. So we have systems that range from fabrication. You need to make something. You need to make a device, a structure, a piece of material. And I'll talk just a little bit about where we're going with some of those fabrication devices. Through our more recent Omicron and Asylum Research businesses, we can now provide the tools that let you look at the surface analysis of those tools, whether that's chemical analysis or structural analysis. So I've made it. So what exactly have I made chemically? And what have I made structurally? Have I made what I thought I was going to make? And then we can go and measure it. And particularly in the areas of quantum computing that we've been most closely involved with, around particularly superconducting qubits. So some of the open questions are, what else is there that we are not seeing enough of? At low temperatures and in high vacuum, and being able through techniques like STM to start manipulate those, we can measure, we can analyze. So we can fabricate them, we can start to characterize, and we can go off and analyze and look at the physics of the devices. So let me talk a little bit just first about device fabrication before we come on to the analysis. There's a big suite of tools here, as you know, and it's interesting seeing some of those silicon photonic structures in the previous talk, because they all come from a very well understood set of techniques, really, of etch techniques, of deposition techniques, and a big toolbox of fabrication methodologies that one can use. Ranging from MBE, where you've got very fine epitaxial layer-by-layer control, into growing nanowires and nanotubes in rather controlled ways, now to be able to deposit my layers and to be able to etch my layers and create a structure. So for us, being able to have a wide tool set across deposition and plasma technologies that allow that is extremely important. And we've probably seen less linkage directly into quantum technology from that, because of course it's a well understood technique. You know, people don't come back and say, I'm making a superconducting qubit of this. They say, we want this particular process to do this. And that's a link we're very keen to understand, of not just what's the process, but how does that link into the application, and what's the process development that we want to feed. And I'll come back to that process word in a second. One of the things as we look forward, of course, is that ability to grow the device. Scalability was something we just heard about in the prior talk as well. So going from research scale, where you might be on a 2-inch wafer or a small chip, you know, just on a wafer carrier, up to 300 and even 400 millimeter wafers. So one of the philosophies, again, that's been behind our fabrication tools has been to be able to go from these quite compact, open loading, research friendly tools, through wafer handling tools, all the way up to production, multi-systems, cassette-to-cassette wafer handling tools. The important thing is, of course, that the process, the set of etch depositions steps that you're going through, travels with you, of course, through that. So while we're scaling up the hardware, the processes travel with it. So you don't have to reinvent the process completely. There'll be some optimization for the tool, but you don't have to reinvent the process going from here to here. The process travels as you go up that scaling point. If you get really enthusiastic, you can end up with a system like this. So this is actually a photovoltaics multi-system, but you can see here, so we've got some PECVD, some deposition chambers here. We've got some sputtering, so we can put down some metallic layers. We've got two etch chambers, so we can run a couple of different etch processes. And we've got an ALD, atomic layer deposition, so we can do some very fine, conformal, thin film coating and deposition onto it, all combined into a single system. And that's quite important, because we know how sensitive these systems are. these devices and materials are. So you can go through all of these multiple stages of etch, deposit, grow, etch, deposit, grow, without taking your sample out until you're finally done. You've got a PECVD, so you could passivate over the top of it, and you've got a real device out of a complete system. I said that process word several times because, of course, what you buy is you buy a piece of hardware, but of course the really, really important thing is, if you like, the software that runs, the process that it runs, the steps it goes through of gas mixes and plasma application to create the particular structure that you're after. And over the last 25 years, we've got a process now of around 6,000 processes, always growing, because this collaboration with major universities and R&D facilities, and there's just a few there, and there's many, many more, is extremely important. So, you know, the first thing is, as somebody comes and says, I want to do this, we can look in the library and say, well, there's a process that we might have it, we might have something that's very close, and we can experiment and tweak and come up with a new process, either singly or together, but we can start to move around. So there's been some quite novel processes that have been developed. So if you see some of these sort of structures which are now used for making high brightness LED chips, really quite unusual structures on substrates that come into there. But importantly, of course, you know, those processes are about being repeatable from wafer to wafer, from sample to sample, for rate, for uniformity, for getting the same thing every time. Because again, this is key to having a device, isn't it? It's not just about making it once, it's about making it again. It's, if you want to scale my device to go up to 40, 50, 100, 256 qubits, those need to be the same. They need to be repeatable, whether they're made on a single wafer or whether they're made across multiple wafers or multiple small chips, they need to be repeatable. So again, you're looking at not qubit to qubit variation, but looking at genuinely what you want to do in the system. I just wanted to mention something specifically about atomic layer deposition, because it's a technique I've been involved with over the years since in Oxford Instruments we started. It's been around for a while, but it's a particularly interesting thing, so I thought it's something that it was worth just spending one slide on. It's a unique capability, really, and atomic layer deposition does exactly what it says. It literally does deposit atomic layers. It's been around for a while. We've been working on it, I guess, for the last 6 or 7 years, and really refining that in. But what it does is it really lets you put monoatomic, monomolecular layers down onto features, and to control those, so you can literally count the number of layers of deposition you want to put down. So if you want very, very fine nanometer layers, whether that's for passivation or for gate structures or capacitor structures or any other structure that's going into your device, you can do that through ALD. And it is also extremely good of going over very high aspect ratio features. So if you've got a very deep structure or something you want to coat top, sides and bottom of the same way, it's an extremely powerful technique. So there's an example there of some carbon nanotubes on which we've deposited some aluminium oxide using a particular plasma ALD process, just enough to react to get the deposition going, but not enough to etch through the carbon nanotubes, as you can see off the EDX graph there. And you don't need to do anything else. You don't need to functionalize the surface. You just put it down and it sticks and it bonds. Second example here, a thin 20 nanometer hafnium oxide layer into some deep silicon trenches. And you really do have, probably can't quite see it on the slides there, but you really do have a completely conformal coating right down into those 25:1 aspect ratio trenches. So a really powerful, really interesting technique. So taking that further forward, we built a system not that long ago for the Quantum Computing Institute at University of Waterloo that was referred to earlier. Really interesting system. Again, this is about putting a piece of unique capability into a lab. It's Big Systems, as you say, it's a $5 million lab. Most of that $5 million was, in fact, the tool. So if you've got a spare $5 million bucks and several square meters, come and talk to me. But what's this let us do? And this now gives a really unique capability to Waterloo to do MBE growth and UHV sputtering growth of multiple materials on the same device. So we can put down metals, metal oxides, superconductors, insulators, all those layers in a single device without exposing it to air, without transferring between tools. We can do XPS chemical analysis in situ and in process. So now I can go layer by layer and check every time I'm doing exactly what I thought I was doing. So an extremely powerful tool that's now part of that armory, if you like, that toolbox for Waterloo. So that's fabrication. Let me talk a little bit more, maybe closer to home and where I am in the business at the moment, particularly about device physics and characterization and some of the things that we're probably best known for in the certainly the quantum computing world, where we're probably most involved in QT overall. So a lot of people, and I know some of you probably use these and know as much, if not more, about them than I do, of these cryo-free, these Triton dilution refrigerators. Interesting story about that, coming back to that idea of what the user does feeding back into what we do. Because the initial obvious advantage of developing these dilution fridges that will take us down to 10 millikelvin, because we know quantum device physics all needs to happen at low temperatures, at least parts of it do, particularly for a lot of the qubit work that our particular customers are doing. So the obvious advantage was just it is cryogen free. There are no helium or cryogens to be used. It makes life simple, it makes life cheap, it makes the availability of the system uptime always there. You're not worried about getting halfway through an experiment, running out of helium, and having to wait 6 weeks for your next allocation. The attraction for QT and QIP really emerged from actually that massively enhanced sample space versus a wet liquid helium dilution fridge. So if you've used one of these, the old style liquid helium fridges, you'll know that you usually get a few tens of millimeters of sample space available to you. You're quite limited in what you can do, never mind all the inconveniences of handling. Now suddenly I've got 240 millimeters down here at 10 milli-K. My real estate, my ability to build devices onto that has massively increased, hugely. And it's very open structure, so you can see all of the space we've got here to bring our experimental access in. And it's easy to use, so you can automatically cool it down, you can hit a button on the computer and say, just go to 10 millikelvin, walk away, come back in the morning, and it will be at 10 millikelvin. That enables a different type of research. And I'll show you how that's panning out in a second. When we get into QIP and control, what do we need? And this is the sort of shopping list that we're starting to work around and starting to explore with customers, partners, and collaborators, and particularly as we move into those quantum technology hubs that we've hopefully got participation in, as depending how the funding goes in September. So we see, this ULT plus all of these electrical things that you need to do, particularly around filtering, amplification, multiplexing, all of those cold electronics that we want to bring into the system that at the moment you are doing, but we would like to be able to provide for you. Magnetic fields, so low temperature is not enough. We need some magnetic field control, and these systems very commonly have those, but again, they are being directed by the user needs. Optical access, whether that's through direct optics or through optical fibers, and even atomic level, whether that's UHV or cooling and trapping gas clusters into the system. So what do we start to get now? So this is going from, we've got a platform, how do we evolve that now for getting those experimental services in? How do we get signal in and out to the interesting place down here at 10 millikelvin? So we've now got a fairly typical system here. We've got two optical fibers, got 96 DC lines we can get in there. We've got 10 rigid coaxes, another 10 flexible coaxes. So we've got a massive amount of wiring we can start to bring down to where my sample is to be interesting. If we load it up, it's a bit of a forest, and if you'd be bothered to count them, there's 24 rigid coaxes in there. So quite a lot of signal coming down here to still less than 15 millikelvin. So that's step one, if you like. You know, we've got a cold platform, great, good for us. But now we need to be directed and add in all of this wiring and signal capability. What else do we need to add in? I said we add in magnets, these sort of three-axis vector magnets where we can start to tilt and manipulate the magnetic field. Again, are things that have come out of specific customer requests for working on quantum technologies, particularly with the Marcus group in Harvard and now in Copenhagen. Where they're doing their measurements using some gallium and arsenide nanowires, and these grow in not always well-defined directions. So by having a magnetic field that you can move around its direction of just purely electrically, you can search out what your alignment of that nanowire is by the magnetic field, and then start to do your experiment by running up that field vector in alignment with your wires. So a rather interesting set of capabilities that's now become, if you like, a standard toolkit. You know, so this is the sort of thing that we say, yeah, that's standard, and we're probably building one or two a month of these sort of magnets already, all very directed into that QIP toolkit. So here's the Marcus Lab at the Niels Bohr Institute, University of Copenhagen. This is one side of it. Because in fact they have six, maybe it's now seven, of these identical dilution fridges here. And what's kind of interesting is this. First of all, nobody ever had six or seven dilution fridges. I mean, you just didn't do it. They were too expensive to run, too detailed to use. You just couldn't do that sort of research before. So by going to cryogen-free and ease of use and ease of handling, suddenly we can go to an almost industrial lab scale of research, where I've got identical systems, so I'm comparing devices, I'm not comparing systems anymore. I'm really getting that fast turnaround of samples. This is the Delft group with van der Sijpen and Koenhoven. Again, they've got five systems over there. I know in Yale, in Rob Shulkoff's group, I think they're about to get numbers 8 and 9 of dilution fridges like these. So there's a real scale up of research that's possible through this sort of tool enablement. It's good for us, and obviously it's good for the community and good for the science. What were some of the things that started to come through, again, back from those users, was that idea of fast throughput. This is great, but if you want to change over your sample in these, you had to warm it up, break the vacuum, take it apart, change your sample, put it back together, and be on a 2 or 3 day turnaround. So, of course, once you've got six or seven systems in your lab, you really want to be turning samples through very fast. So one of the pieces of work we've done, again, very collaboratively with customers, is this an idea of top loading sample exchanges with a sample puck that goes in and takes that down to an 8 hour turnaround. This is all very good, but it top loads, so it's not very big. It's you've maybe got about 30 millimeter sample space in there. So where we've gone now, again, with the customer interaction, is to load these from the bottom, so we haven't got the restrictions coming up from the top. You can see if you've got a magnet here, you can load up, put your puck in, and withdraw. I've got 70 millimeters of sample space, so I've now got a lot of space in there that I can put my qubit structures in. I can have 40 gigahertz lines, I can have 50 DC lines, and that takes me 8 hours to cool down. So I can do an experiment, I can swap over my experiment at the end of day, and it will be back at 10 millik the next morning for me to come back and do the next run of experiments. So experimental throughput time to first experiment, but time between experiments starts to get extremely fast. If you want to be convinced, there's the graph that tells you it's 8 hours, and actually we've done some measurements that you can see that connecting and disconnecting is extremely reliability. You don't lose your those attenuations don't get any worse as you go through. We did some work with the IARPA program, and this is taking us on to the next level, really. So we've gone through platform to wiring to how do I get my sample in and out easily, now to so what do I mount my sample on? What really happens down at that business end? And one of the things that came out of the IARPA consortium were these pucks, if you like, these sample mountings, these standardized, what was called the IARPA puck, that would let all of the partners in the program, again, work off a common standard, a common set of signal interfaces, a common sample mounting method, so you're really comparing like with like in terms of instrumentation. So that's something that we've worked with them, and something we're very interested to take forward now and say, it's probably not this particular design, but what's the design of PUC that we could take forward that again gives you more ability to get that fast throughput of samples. Final couple of things. So, you know, enough is never enough, of course. Scientists are, you know, everyone wants more. So I said it was great, wasn't it? We had 240 millimeters of real estate cold at 10 millikelvin. Wow, you know, we've never had that in the last 50 years. And then someone said, can we have some more, please? So we developed this, and actually, having built one, we've now suddenly built about six of these and seeing continual requests for them, because now we can go at 10 millik and below to 430 millimeters of sample space. So now I've got almost half a meter diameter of cold sample space to put my qubits on, my whole structure on. I can mount any sort of magnet I like off this, really, 16 Tesla, big vector, rotate magnets, anything you like. So now I've gone from these sort of line of sights where we had 1x50, 2x40, 1x65. So these line of sight ports that we can bring our those sets of coax that I showed you earlier. Now look at this. So I've got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 plus a massive one down the middle. So if I end up with six 50 millimeters, 100 millimeter line of sight port. So now I can either be really cold. So these will run to below five millikelvin if you don't load them up too much. Or I can say I'm not so interested in base temperature, but I want a huge amount of wiring on them now, and I'll load it up and I can get all that space and get cold. So that's kind of the toolbox. That's what's evolved as the toolbox and where it is evolving. Very QIP quantum computing driven, because that's where the main customer base for us has been. So commercially, that's probably not unexpected. Where do we want to go for that, and where's the dialogue we want to continue with this community? Onboard cold electronics, the filtering, the multiplex, the amplifiers, absolutely. That seems the obvious next stage from where we've been. Enhanced measurements, so we've got some collaboration going on about electron temperature thermometry, for instance. Standardized measurement pucks. Is there a standard? Can the community live with something that becomes standard enough? That we can provide that for you. Certainly looking forward to close participation and having some sponsored students within the QT hubs that are coming out. So that's a key part of that feedback mechanism. And for discussion, what's the sort of things I'd like to hear back from all of you guys in the follow-up and later on? What are we not seeing QC, QIP? What are the things that you want to come back and say, if you could do that for me, that would solve this problem? What are the things that we're not yet seeing that are in QT beyond the QC, QIP? That's the, you know, the big headline topic, that is the sort of Times supplements topic, but there's a whole lot else in there. And of course, in the QT hubs, there's a lot on sensors and different implementations of quantum technologies. But we need to see, so what's that next generation beyond the QC elements? So thank you for listening. Thank you for putting up with, I feel like, the slightly greasy engineer coming into the the clean room of scientists. But hopefully that gives you some good insight. familiar as you might be with some parts of it. And where's that toolbox? And certainly, hopefully, that impetus to say that toolbox needs to evolve as the science evolves, as the technology evolves, and something that we need to work on as a community together. Thank you.